Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Know-How is brought to you by CashFly at CACHEFLY.com.
This episode of Know-How is brought to you by Lynda.com. Learn what you want when you want with access to over 2,700 high-quality online courses, all for one low monthly price. To try it free for 7 days, visit lynda.com/know-how. That's LYNDA.com/know-how. On this episode of Know-How, it's all about Windows RDP. That's right, the Remote Desktop Protocol. And Aaron Newcomb comes around for Linux Tips, part
this sudo part 2.
Welcome to Know How. It's the Twitch show where we build, bend, break, and upgrade. I'm Father Robert Ballister.
And I'm Brian Burnett.
And for the next 30 minutes or so, I'd say today, we're going to be showing you some of the projects that we've been using over the last few weeks so that you can geek out in your own time. But before we get to that, Brian, I want to talk about leaves.
Leaves?
Leaves.
Oh, yeah, like the kinds on trees, right?
Yeah, that's, you know, leaves are good. Plants turn carbon dioxide and water into oxygen, and that's always a good thing.
Photosynthesis, right?
Photosynthesis, exactly what we're talking about. But, you know, when we start talking about space flight, because you know I'm all about space. I love me some space.
Mm-hmm.
One of the issues is it's difficult to maintain a garden, a greenhouse, that would be big enough to do the carbon dioxide breakdown in such a large area.
Right. And, you know, colonizing planets and stuff like that.
Yeah. And so what we've been using is we use technologies right now that don't actually break carbon dioxide back down. They sequester it. They filter out the carbon dioxide, and then they just pump in more nitrogen, more oxygen to make up the difference.
There has to be a better way.
There's a better way. And actually, an art student from the Royal College of Art has come up with what he says is going to be the future of space flight, the future at least of carbon dioxide sequestration in space flight. He's come up with a way to create an emulsion, a silk protein that contains the chloroplasts that are the part of a plant cell that are responsible for photosynthesis,
right,
and keep them alive.
Wow.
Now, the cool thing about this is it means that if you shine light on it, it will take water and carbon dioxide and it will give you
oxygen,
which is cool. And actually, Alex, if you go to that page, these are some of the prototypes. He's made this man-made leaf. It's not really a leaf. It's a way to get the chloroplast working with light. Here's the thing. It's a really cool idea, and I don't think there's anything that's stopping this from working. Mm-hmm. But especially if you read the article, which is incredibly light. And if you look at the video, I think it's more of a concept right now.
Right.
Because to me, there's one big bunk part of this, and that is the photosynthesis process in a plant works because the plant needs the carbohydrates. It needs the simple sugars that it creates.
Mm-hmm.
It takes carbon dioxide. It takes H2O and some electron donors. Then it uses light to create two molecules of CH2O plus O2, oxygen, right?
Right.
So you have a place where the carbon's going. The carbon is going to feed the plant. That's what it does.
But in this instance,
there's no plant.
So
what happens to all the carbon and the hydrogen that has been liberated? They don't really touch on it. So either it saturates, either it just builds up until it's useless, or they've got some really cool process that they haven't described yet that allows that byproduct to be sloughed off.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, my guess is that they're probably getting to that point. Maybe they haven't figured that out yet, but the concept is pretty neat.
The concept is neat because it means that you could essentially spray this emulsion on anything. So you could spray it on the inside of a spacecraft, and suddenly the entire spacecraft is an oxygen garden.
Right.
Just give it light, and it's good to go, right? And imagine if you had a transparent dome, you just spray the transparent dome, and so light comes in through the dome, and you get oxygen out on the other side. But I really do want to find out what they do with all the carbon and the hydrogen that it strips out.
Right, because the byproducts.
The byproduct. I'm betting that right now it just slowly clogs the emulsion until
it's useless.
It's useless. It won't work anymore. and that actually could be a bigger problem than having dairy plants.
Yeah, that could be an issue at some point.
Yeah.
But yeah, very cool idea. And, you know, using a process that's already been developed over millions of years.
By nature.
You know, it's a good idea to try and adapt some of those policies into
our
technology.
Why not? Yeah, and that's what we like. This is like when we talked about solar roadways. We're like, we didn't think, this is not going to work. But you can adopt parts of the technology for something that might actually work. I'm sure there's a long way to go before the spray-on oxygen garden is ready to go. But I think it's fantastic that they figured a way to keep the chloroplast active outside of a biological entity.
Yeah, definitely. Cool.
Science. Okay. All right, let's move on. So we promised the fans of the show that today we were going to be talking about Windows Remote Desktop.
Yes.
Now, I know there's going to be a lot of people out there who are going to go, I don't use Windows. I'm only Linux or I'm only... Oh, fine. Whatever it is. Here's the cool thing. Remote Desktop actually works across platforms.
Right.
So if you're ever trying to use a Windows box, you can use RD on a Mac. You can use RD on an Android device. I've actually got a remote desktop client on my phone.
Very cool. You can use
it in Linux. So it's one of these things where even if Windows isn't your primary system, or actually I'd say especially if Windows isn't your primary system, this is a really good way to control that Windows box from anywhere.
Yeah, I mean, that could be helpful for a lot of people, because if you're like me, you have a Windows PC at home, I have a Mac laptop, and then I have an Android phone.
Right.
And if I could remote desktop to my laptop or my desktop from my phone, the platform doesn't matter as long as you can remote into it.
Oh, absolutely. And it's super useful. I use it all the time because I have multiple boxes, and most of them are in the data closet. They do their own thing. It's easier for me to remote desktop into those boxes, and then I have one monitor in my office that's dedicated to the 8 boxes that I have RD'd. And so I can see them all at a glance, but they're not in my room, and I don't have to worry about them heating anything up. But let's move on a little bit. So when we're talking about RD, we really want to talk about RDP. So that's the remote desktop protocol. RD is just remote desktop.
Okay.
Now, you need two sides of it. You need the server side and you need the client side.
Yeah.
Right? Because the server is what's going to allow something to connect to it.
Right.
Whereas the client just connects.
Right, just accepts the transmission.
Right, so you need both sides if you want remote desktop to work properly. But when we talk about RDP, it's a protocol that goes way, way, way back. It started off with Windows-based terminal client, terminal service client protocol. It was a proprietary protocol that Microsoft developed, and they included in Windows NT.
Oh,
so
okay.
way back. Yeah. And the idea was very simple. It was a thin client. It was the ability to use your terminal to connect to a server and use the resources of the server to do your work.
Makes sense. Yeah.
Makes sense, right.
Very helpful.
It actually worked really well.
Yeah.
But it has evolved over the years, and it's been included in every release of Windows since NT.
Right.
So it was in NT, it was in 2000, it was in XP, it was in ME, it was in Vista, it was in... a 7,
so
and it's
everything.
An 8.
Yeah.
It's an 8, right. Now, the cool thing about this is, again, since it is so long-lived, it's supported by so many different operating systems. There are so many different clients. And even though it's a proprietary protocol, they've all been able to use it to connect to a RD server-equipped box.
Cool. So, yeah, it doesn't matter what you're running. Yeah. Are you going to show us how to use it?
I will, but first, okay, there's a few things you have to know about it. It supports 32-bit color, which is nice.
Yeah.
It also supports smart card authentication. So if you wanted to use this in an enterprise setting, which is really what it's designed for, you could have tight access controls based on an encrypted smart card.
Because I could see this being exploited.
Right. Yeah. I think it was between versions 5 and 6, they increased the options for local usage. Because you're using a remote computer, but like let's say you're editing a video file or you're playing a video, you actually want that to show up on your computer.
Right.
Or if you're printing a document in your terminal window, you want to show it up on your printer, not in the computer that might be 1,000 miles away.
Right.
So they've increased the local access options so that you can make things local or remote depending on what kind of application you have.
And is that a recent thing?
It's not super recent, but it did come after the initial development of remote desktop.
Okay.
It also has RSC's RC4 cipher that encrypts with either a 56 or a 120-bit encryption key, which sounds good,
yeah.
But a while back, they figured out that the 128-bit encryption that it was doing wasn't perfect because it was encrypting the same keystroke with different hashes. And if someone was watching the stream and they got enough data, they could actually just compare and reverse engineer the key and then watch everything on the stream. So
is nothing safe, Padre?
It's not safe. I would not count on the encryption saving you. I would count on the encryption being a deterrent for just like a light hacker.
Okay. Right. Okay. So it's better than nothing.
It's better than nothing. But I would say this. If you're going to use RDP, do not use it thinking, oh, yeah, it's totally encrypted. It's totally secure.
Oh, yeah.
Unless you encapsulate it in something else. Like, for example, it listens on TCP and UDP port 3389. Remember we talked about port forwarding?
Yes.
I know people who port forwarded 3389 TCP and UDP to their Windows box and then left it open to the world. Well,
does that mean anyone could remote desktop in then? Or?
Yeah. That's not good. I mean, there's authentication.
You look like you have a guilty face when you say that.
Well, I did experiments when I was...
I was testing.
I needed the money. One of the other cool things is the protocol can also take advantage of load balancing. So if you've got a couple of these boxes inside of a data center and you've got a load balanced system, it's a natural fit.
Okay.
Now, that's enough of the technical
stuff. That's the details.
Now what we need to do is we need to show you how you set up the server and how you set up the client. So here's a little bit of Microsoft Windows Remote Desktop.
Step one is to determine what remote desktop functionality is baked into your version of Windows. All modern versions of Windows have the remote desktop client integrated into the operating system, but sadly, not all of them have remote desktop server. The Windows versions that do have remote desktop server are Windows XP Professional, Vista Professional, Business and Ultimate, Windows 7 Professional, Ultimate and Enterprise, Windows 8 Professional, and Enterprise. If you don't know which version of Windows you're running, the easiest way to check is to see if it actually runs remote desktop server. On the desktop, right-click the icon labeled Computer. Now in the drop-down menu, click Properties, then click Remote Settings. If the pop-up remote window only has a box for turning remote assistance connections on and off, then your Windows box supports RD Client, but not RD Server. This means that you can connect to a Windows box running RD Server, but your computer cannot be connected to. RD Server is disabled by default, so assuming that your Windows box supports RD Server, the second step is to enable the service. In the same remote pop-up, you should see three radio buttons. The first one is Don't Allow Connections to This Computer. The second is Allow Connections from Computers Running Any Version of Remote Desktop. And the third is Allow Connections Only from Computers Running Remote Desktop with Network Level Authentication. Network Level Authentication, or NLA, does not allow a client to connect unless that client first authenticates itself to the remote desktop server. This is the preferred method because it means that an attacking computer won't be able to create a session until it has first submitted proper credentials. This saves the resources of the RD server and mitigates the chances of RDP being used as a vector for denial of service attacks. Clearly, our preference is to use option 3, but if you're using an older or non-standard client, you may need to select option 2. Step 3 is to select which users can access your computer. In the remote box, click Select Users, and the Remote Desktop Users window will open. The dialog box will allow you to add any existing users on the local computer to the remote desktop access list. If you want to add additional users, you must first add them to the local user accounts. Go into the Windows Users Account screen and add users. Then go back into Remote Desktop and add those newly created users to your access list. Your remote desktop server is now ready to receive connections. Now that the server is up, step 4 is to set up the client you'll be using to connect to the remote desktop server. I'm going to use Windows as my example since, well, it's what I use. From the desktop of the client computer, start the program named Remote Desktop Connection. Remember that this will work on all modern Windows machines, even if you don't have RD Server. To access the box with RD Server, you need either the IP address of the box, and you need to have a routable path to that IP address, or you need the network name. The network name will only work if both computers are on the same network and if your administrator hasn't blocked network names, so I prefer to set my box with a static IP and access it with the IPv4 address. You could just click Connect and use all the default settings, but there are some advanced options that are very useful for tweaking remote desktop. Click Show Options to drop down the advanced options. The first menu that you'll see is the one that lets you enter your username and choose whether or not remote desktop connection will store your credentials. If you check the box, always ask for credentials, then the client will not cache your credentials and you will be prompted for username and password every time you establish a connection. If the box is not checked, then the client will automatically submit your username and password. In the tab marked Display, you'll find controls for resolution and color depth. This is useful if you know that you'll be connecting with bandwidth limitations. You can reduce the resolution of the screen and drop the color depth to better survive bandwidth hiccups. Under the Local Resources tab are all the controls for audio, input, printers, and clipboard. You can set events to happen on either the remote server or on the client side. In the Programs tab is the option to have programs automatically run upon startup. This is useful if you have software that you'll use each time you make a connection. The Experience tab lets you tweak bandwidth settings, useful if you want to force a low-quality connection to better cope with inconsistent speeds. The Advanced tab allows you to set your server authentication and security options. Once the settings are to your liking, click Connect, and you should establish a session on your RD server.
We've got Sean in the chat room who's asking if we're going to pixelize those IPs. Those are all internal IPs, so
yeah.
You could hit them all you want. It wouldn't actually affect us. So.
Maybe he was being sarcastic.
I hope
it just doesn't translate over chat.
We've trained chat room. Anytime they see an IP, they're like, oh, we're not supposed to see that. It's cool. It's cool. I understand. But Sean does bring up a very important point,
right.
And that is if you're going to use a static, if you're going to port forward, remember that your IP becomes sacred. I mean, someone's probably going to scan it, but you don't want to be handing it out to people. I know you DMZ'd your computer a while back.
So we would not want to be showing that IP address.
Probably not.
I still got to take care of that.
But I can't stress enough. If you're going to use this to access your computer outside of your network, which a lot of you will, like I do, the way that I do it is I have a VPN back into my network, and then I remote desktop from there to the computer that I need to control.
Right.
I would not ever suggest that you make the port open public facing. That is just asking for disaster. And the other part is if you don't trust your internal network,
then don't do it either.
Yeah, unless you're able to firewall or VLAN yourself off from all the other traffic on the network, don't do it. I mean, it's not a trusted protocol. It really isn't. It has security features, but I would just assume that people are always trying to attack it, and I can break into RDP pretty easily.
Yeah, and that's why you'd recommend doing a VPN before using RDP. Yeah.
Now, another thing, again, I want to emphasize this. If you go ahead and move to my computer, number 10, Alex, what you'll see here is this is the computer I've got on the desktop right now. I'm using the name of the computer, which is Arch instead of the IP because it's dynamic here. But this option right here for display is going to be super, super important to you if you are using VPN or if you are on a bandwidth limited selection, because the default is it will go full display. It will give you as big as possible. But sometimes, especially if you've got limited bandwidth, you are going to want to use a lower resolution screen so that it can handle it. You also want to be able to use this. Like, for example, some people were saying, oh, I'd go through Tor. You could go through Tor. You're going to get horrible, horrible connection.
Right.
So you'd want to have to say, pretend like I'm a modem.
Yeah.
Because the more that you adjust it for the speed you're actually going to have, the better your experience is going to be. It's much better than having a huge screen that works fast for a couple seconds and then stops because it has to buffer everything.
That's super frustrating when you're trying to drag and drop files or something like that, and then it's like... And then you lose them. You're not sure where you put them.
Exactly. It's like, I think it's there. Let me go get some coffee and I'll find out where it landed. But in a future episode of Know How, our very own Cranky Hippo is going to take us through how you use RDP on a Mac.
Yes. Yeah, actually, if you do just a simple search for remote desktop in the Mac store, it pops up under Microsoft Remote Desktop. So check it out. And I'll be doing some more info on it later. Yeah.
By the way, this has long been used by users of iPads because, they've always said, it's hard to get stuff done. I want Microsoft Office. I want blah, blah, blah.
Well, I want to sit on the couch and not have to walk to the other room.
Exactly. So they use their tablet to RDP to the desktop that they want to connect to, and boom, it's right there.
Well, another program that I use a lot is called TeamViewer. And that works good on Android and stuff like that.
Right. And there is one more wrinkle, which is here in the Brick House, we've got our engineering staff researching a newer version of RDP that uses a faster protocol that should allow for what's called GPU-assisted remote desktop. So instead of transmitting the data over the connection, it allows me to use the GPU in my computer to redraw the frames.
Oh, okay.
It's much better, especially if you wanted to do, I don't know, say, remote desktop video editing.
Oh, yeah. Or gaming?
Oh. Well, yeah.
Can we do that? Or TD says no.
Coin mining?
Oh.
Much Doge.
We did get a lot of new graphics cards the other day.
We got four of them.
Yes. But anyway.
We've locked those away in the cage where you can't get to them.
Now, when we come back, we're going to be bringing Aaron Newcomb back here. He wants to give us another set of tips for Linux. But before we do that, we need to take a pause to thank the first sponsor of this episode of Know How, and that's Linda. Now, Brian, we've talked often about the knowledge hole, right?
Oh, absolutely.
The knowledge hole you got to fill up.
That's if you want your knowledge hole to grow, you got to keep filling it.
You got to keep filling it. And one of the best places I found to fill it online is Linda. They are the one-stop shop for information about pretty much anything. It doesn't have to be technological. No. They've got courses that cover skill sets, that cover hobbies, that cover things like photography, and, of course, every program you may need to learn in a competitive marketplace. That's what makes Linda so good. It is that central repository to fill the knowledge hole. They really should use that as their...
I don't know if they're going to go for that, but we'll keep trying.
Well, Linda is the place that helps you keep up to date with your software. It helps you learn those brand new skills that you need and explore new hobbies with easy-to-follow video tutorials. Whether you want to take better pictures and videos with your DSLR, learn from the best about programming skills to develop your own mobile apps, or edit your own video footage using Final Cut Pro 10 or Premiere, Lynda.com offers thousands of video courses on a variety of topics. For any software you might rely upon, including Microsoft Office, Adobe Creative Cloud, Final Cut Pro, Logic Pro, and more, Linda helps you stay current with product updates to learn how to be more efficient and productive in your professional or personal life. Lynda.com recently released a new iPhone and iPad app for iOS 7 and enhanced their Android app to provide Chromecast support. The iOS app includes a more visual, intuitive interface, and both new apps offer online courses and video viewing, allowing you to learn in any environment. Lynda.com users can move seamlessly between mobile and desktop applications, meaning that you're never more than a click away from the lesson that you need. Now, the new courses, the one that I'm really pumped up about, is Photography 101 Shooting Macros and Close-Ups, Camera Movement for Video Production. Now, they also offer Excel 2013 Tips and Tricks and Managing Stress, but it's this Photography 101 course that has me so abuzz because once you get to, you know, a certain level of videography, a certain level of photography, you want to get rid of all the bad habits. And this is one of those courses that will take you through it and show you how you should take those close-up shots, how you should take those macro shots, how you should set up your shot with light and angles. It's a really good way to learn something that I'm passionate about.
Well, for me, I was working on Shannon's phone. I was taking apart that Nexus 5, and so I checked out this lesson just so I could make sure I wasn't going to do any mistakes while taking that thing apart.
Exactly. You know, especially when we're working on know-how, we want to get the shot right the first time. And you know, this is a nice, easy way to learn. It actually gives you a visual representation. It's not just do this. It's this is what it looks like when you take this shot. And that's the way we learn. We learn visually.
And this one's with a puppy.
And a puppy. Now, Linda has over 2,700 courses with more added weekly. All Lynda.com courses are produced at the highest quality, not like some of those homemade videos on YouTube, which we love, but, you know, sometimes you want good lighting, sometimes you want good sound, and sometimes you want a coherent lesson plan. That's what you get with Linda. Lynda.com works with software companies to provide you updated training the same day new versions hit the market, so you always have the latest skills. They've got courses for all experience levels, from beginner, intermediate, and advanced. And whether you have 15 minutes or 15 hours, each course is structured so that you can learn from start to finish. You can also search the transcripts to find the quick answers or read along with the video to help you learn the way you need to learn. So here's what we want you to do. We want you to try Linda. Learn something new today with Lynda.com. It's only $25 a month for access to the entire Lynda.com course library. Or for $37.50 a month, you can subscribe to the premium plan, which includes exercise files that let you follow along with the instructor's projects using the exact same assets. And you can try lynda.com right now with a free 7-day trial. Visit lynda.com/knowhow to access the entire library. That's over 2,700 courses free for 7 days. It's all at lynda.com/knowhow. And we thank Lynda for their support of KnowHow.
Anything that helps fill your knowledge hole.
Boom. Boom. Speaking of the knowledge hole, we always get the people who are into the open source and the Linux, because we love them.
Yeah, you know, absolutely.
We do it here all the time with the Pi, who say, well, you do a lot with Windows, you do a lot with Mac, but you don't do enough with Linux.
We got to spread the love.
We got to spread the love.
And that's why we keep inviting our guest expert, Aaron Newcomb, to keep coming up to the studio.
And so here to spread the love, here's some Newcomb.
Hey, I'm Aaron Newcomb, and I'm back for another segment where we're going to talk about some Linux tips and tricks. And if you remember from last time, we talked about the various distributions of Linux or the flavors of Linux that you can go out and get. And we talked about Ubuntu, we talked about Fedora or the different Red Hat versions. And then I told you about Linux Mint, and that's what we're going to be focusing on because it's really easy to use. It's a good one to get started with. So Linux Mint is what we're going to be installing. Now, before we install, you'll notice it's a little bit different than installing software right on top of your Windows existing operating system or installation, right? What we're going to be doing is we're going to be installing a whole operating system. So it's going to be a little bit different than you're used to if you haven't done this before. So what you want to do is you want to go to the Linux Mint website, linuxmint.com, and click on download. That's going to give you some options. So here's a bunch of download links. Which one do I choose? Well, really, any of them will work. The one that I like is called Cinnamon, and all these different choices are basically different versions of what the GUI looks like that's running on top of all the stuff, the operating system. So, you know, you can kind of think of it as each one of these is going to have slightly different programs that run, maybe a different file browser, or maybe a few different options here or there. It's going to look slightly different. There are screenshots of all the various desktops if you want to go check out and see what they look like. But if I were you, I would stick with the very first one at the top called Cinnamon. Now, most of you at this point are going to be able to download the 64-bit version. That's the one you're going to want. The 32-bit version is what we used to use before we were able to run 64-bit operating systems. So if you're running this on a very old PC that's not able to do 64-bit, maybe it's 4 or 5 years old. Maybe 32-bit is the choice for you. But anything, you know, newer than 4 or 5 years old, you're going to want to run the 64-bit version. So all you have to do is click on that link, and it will ask you to download from various sites, depending on where you're at. Now, we happen to be on the West Coast here in the U.S., and I downloaded this earlier just to make sure it would work. But you can see if you're in a different country, you might want to choose a download server that's close to you. I chose this one called, very generically, U.S. Internet. I have no idea where that is, but it was a very quick download. So that's the one we chose, and it downloaded really quickly. We're not going to sit through that process again. It's going to download something called an ISO file. And you can see I've got some here that I've already downloaded. ISO files are basically what they've done is they've taken the operating system with all of the install software that you need to get it on your computer. They've wrapped it up into a single file that would fit on a CD. ISO files are basically CD images. And so what you're going to have to do to get this installed once you've downloaded it is either use a USB stick or an old-fashioned CD, or in this case, a DVD, because it's big enough to fit on a DVD. So you'd have to take a DVD. There are, in Windows, it's actually really easy to burn. You can just right-click on it, and you say burn disk image. And if you've got a DVD writer in your desktop or laptop, it'll actually burn that really easily. If you want to do it from a USB, because not everybody has CD or DVD capability anymore, you can actually just do a Google search online, how to burn an ISO image to a USB drive. And you'll come up with hundreds of tutorials on how to do that. So we're not going to cover that now. For our purposes, so I can show this to you most effectively, I'm actually going to run this in VirtualBox. Now, VirtualBox is something that you may want to consider if you just want to try this out or play with it. It's a great virtual system emulator which is put out by Oracle. Sun purchased VirtualBox and then Oracle purchased Sun. So it's part of Oracle now, but it is a really great utility. If you've never played with it before, lots of good tutorials on VirtualBox, but you really don't need to do this. I'm just doing it for demonstration purposes today. So let's go ahead and fire up. So what I'm going to do is pretend that I've put this either in my USB, the thumb drive in my computer, or on a CD. And when you boot up your computer, you're going to want to tell it to boot from the USB device or the CD-ROM in your system. There should be a function key you can press when you start your computer that lets you choose where to boot from. And that's where you're going to want to pick that option. And when you do that, it'll look something like this. We're going to start this up. And this is what it'll look like if you start it up from start your computer up and choose to boot off that image. You'll get this screen right here, Linux Mint, automatic boot. Just let it go ahead and go. There's some advanced choices that you can put in if you don't want it to automatically boot, but we're going to ignore those for now and assume that you're a basic user just wanting to either try this out or install it on your system. While it's booting up, a couple things I'll tell you about. One is that most of these ISO images that you're downloading are actually live versions of the operating system. What that means is that you can stick them in you can boot off them. It's not going to install anything to your hard drive or overwrite the files you have on your computer. It's actually going to load all the files that are in the off the CD or off the USB stick into the memory that's in your computer, and it's going to run completely in memory. So you're not going to have to worry. You can try it out. You can browse the operating system. You can use the browser. You can use the word processor. You can use all that stuff. And when you're done, you just exit out, take the CD out, and reboot into Windows or Mac OS or whatever you're using. So it looks like the operating system is coming up now. We'll just give it a few more minutes to start up. It's a little slow because I'm running it in VirtualBox and not on bare metal hardware here. All right, so our operating system is up and running. So this is the live CD running off that ISO image that we downloaded before. In my case, it's running in VirtualBox, so you can ignore the title bar up here. But this is exactly what it would look like if it was running on your desktop natively. It would look just like this. So you've got icons on the screen. One of them says Install Linux Mint. We'll get there in a minute. And then you have a menu bar down here at the bottom. This is a live operating system. It will work just maybe a little slower, but for all intents and purposes, everything should work just like it does on once it gets installed on a live system. So we could, for example, start up Firefox. That'll come up. And we could actually, if you're connected to the internet, you could actually browse right off this live CD. This is a great way to troubleshoot other problems with other operating systems. This is how I troubleshoot systems like Windows that are having problems. Maybe there's some corruption on the hard drive or something. You can always boot off this live CD and use it just like you would any other operating system. So let's just go to google.com just to show you that it is working. And there's Google, and everything works fine. Now, one common issue that you're going to have is that when you install Windows, for example, on your hard drive, you're going to find that it uses the entire partition by default when you install Windows. So there's going to be no space left on your hard drive to install this. Well, luckily with the Linux Mint Live CD, they have some tools that you can use to take advantage of this. Now, I will caution you before we get started that this is not something that you want to do ad hoc or if you don't know what you're doing, because you could erase files on your system. But if you do some research online, this is you can find that it's actually pretty safe to go ahead and follow the procedure that I'm outlining here. So what we're going to do is we're not going to look at the computer. What we're going to do is start a terminal window right down here at the bottom. There's a terminal. Just click on that once. It's going to open up. And they've included some software to help us check our hard drive to make sure that it's partitioned correctly. What you want to type in here is sudo, S-U-D-O. Gparted, all one word. That's going to start the Gparted program, which is going to take a look at our hard drive and tell us what it sees. So this is what our hard drive looks like right now. It shows a 12 gig, I know that's small, but a 12 gig partition on our hard drive, and it's formatted for NTFS. So if you were running Windows, it would look something like this, except that it would show that there was data here. There would be some yellow coloring in here to show how much data was used in that particular partition. What we're going to do real quick is we are going to resize this partition so that we have some room to install Linux alongside of Windows. So to do that, I'm just going to right-click and choose Resize. Again, this is where you want to make sure you know what you're doing. If you don't, feel free to use Google and do some research. I know that I'm not using any space in this partition, so I'm going to cut it all the way back to 2 gig. That will leave me 10 gig to install Linux. I'll hit Resize. That's staged everything, and now to commit my changes, I have to click this little arrow, Apply All Operations, which I will do. Now, Gparted is going to go out, and it's going to shrink that partition down. If this were a real large, like a terabyte or 2 terabyte disk, it would take quite a while to do this. But because we're doing this virtually with a very small partition, it goes very quickly. Okay, so that's done. So I'm going to hit Close. Now everything's ready for us to install Linux Mint. We should have 10 gig available, and it'll say unallocated. And then once that's done, you can close that down. And next time, I'll go ahead and show you how to actually step through the install process. We'll see you next time.
I want to thank Aaron for that. Now, you thought that you should probably explain one quick thing to the audience, right?
What sudo does
sudo.
And what that means.
Yeah,
because you'll be using
lot.
It a lot, and it's kind of a powerful tool, so you don't want to miswield it.
Yeah, so basically what sudo is super user do. Linux and all the good operating systems, including Mac, they allow you to temporarily escalate your privileges. So,
right.
Because you remember, you don't want to run it as administrator. If you're running as root or running as administrator, you're just asking for something bad to happen to your computer. So the more advanced operating systems have you run as a dependent user, as a lower level user, and then you can use the sudo command to tell it, for this process, for this thing I want to do, like sudo apt-get,
right.
To go get something from the internet, install it on the computer, let me run as a super user,
right.
And then remove the privilege once I'm done.
For this one thing.
This
and
one
it's just
thing.
Safer to do it that
Much
way.
Much safer to do it that way.
Because
yeah.
Then you run into the problem. What was it? Somebody was running their Linux box as
root.
As root,
oh, that's
yeah.
That's just asking for trouble.
And yeah, it just got...
You'll get owned. I mean, that's the thing. Look, Windows users, because our operating system is a little retarded that way, and it allows us to run this... And in fact, I'm running as administrator on these computers right now.
Yeah.
We've gotten used to, yeah, I could really screw this up, so I have to be careful.
Right.
If you're a Linux user and you're running it super user, not only do you now have all the vulnerabilities of a Windows machine, but right. Many of the things... that you would take for granted that are safe are no longer safe.
Right.
Just don't,
right.
Don't do it. That's a bad thing.
So, yeah.
Be safe. Sudo is your friend.
Yes.
All right, now, before we go, I thought it might be time to give a parting shot to our people in the Google Plus community.
Yeah. Check out some of the problems that they've been having in there.
We have one here. If you could go ahead and switch to my computer, Alex, from John Hui. He says, hello, KH fans. I hope one of you and Father Robert can help. They never call you out. They should call you out more.
I have no help to give.
He says, I have an AT&T U-verse 2-wire 3801 HGV modem, and he plugs into one of the LAN ports on an ASUS RT-AC68U router. The ASUS has VPN capability. I've been trying to figure out how to set it up. Did lots of Google searches and tried, but no luck. I know I have to somehow make the ASUS... to have an external IP address, but since it is plugged into the 2-wire, it's not letting it. I tried to change the settings in the 2-wire to have enable detection of router behind router conditions. Any suggestions and detail of solution would be great. Okay, so there's a few things wrong here. First, you've got your 2-wire modem plugged into the LAN port of the ASUS router. You don't do that. It would actually go into the WAN port.
Okay.
Now, you're NATing a NAT, which is never a good idea. But
you got your NAT on NAT?
It's NAT on NAT action. You got
okay.
NAT on NAT action, which is never good. But unfortunately, you really don't have a choice. Gone are the days where most of the cable companies and telcos would give you either your DSL modem and your cable modem, and then you would supply the router. Most units today include some sort of router along with the modem, which... it's a pain in the butt for anyone who's trying to do a bit more detailed setup.
Right.
Especially since the routers they normally include them with are kind of
crummy.
Crippled. They're horrible.
Yeah.
They're bad. They're
I've noticed that they've been pushing that. Comcast
they
has
really
been pushing it.
And that's just because they know that if you run your own router, you can do things like running your own VPNs. And
right.
They want you to pay for business class service.
No, thank you.
No, thank you. So this is how you're going to settle it. Unfortunately, you can't turn off the router settings on 2-wire. It won't let you do that. But what you can do is plug the 2-wire into the WAN port. That's the external port of your ASUS router, and then set the IP on the ASUS for a static. And you can go back to a couple of episodes of Know How ago, and I'll show you how to do that. And then in the 2-wire router, you set that static IP as the DMZ. That means any traffic that comes in on the external port of the 2-wire router will go straight to that ASUS router. That should allow you to set up the VPN. Now, if you do it that way, if you set it up to the WAN port, then the 2 wires NAT into NAT function mm-hmm. should give you a little better functionality.
Okay, and there's not a lot of risk at having the NAT open on the or the DMZ on the second one. There's no because you're already behind the first router.
No, there are issues.
Oh, there are issues.
You really don't want to run a NAT on a NAT.
Okay.
It's a very non-ideal situation.
Yeah.
Unfortunately,
this is the way he's going to have to do
it. Unless there's a way. I don't know. Maybe you have a great provider. If you can contact them and say, I have my own router. All I want is the modem.
Right.
Then sometimes it'll work. Also, Comcast, this is a super pain in the butt, but I have seen it done.
What isn't with Comcast?
Know, right? You can disable. They can actually turn off all the routing features and make it a dumb modem. Oh. But you cannot do it from the user side. It has to be done from their side.
Why does that not surprise
And they won't
me?
Tell you that they can do it. You have to keep fighting. You're like, I know I can do this. All you have to do is do this. And finally, they'll do it.
What ended up happening to me is I bought my own modem because I didn't want to have to pay the rental fee because I think it's like after a year, it pays for itself. And then after, I think it's been 2 years that I've had it, they're like, yeah, your modem's out of date, so we're going to send you a new one. I was like, no, don't.
They do that a lot now. Like, oh, yeah, we noticed that yours, it doesn't fit the new DOCSIS standard that we're using.
Right.
And what they've done in Vegas, this is even worse. If you buy a modem,
yeah,
every 6 months they slightly change the DOCSIS standard that they're using,
uh-huh.
so that your modem suddenly starts going incredibly slow.
That's exactly what happened to me.
And like, oh well, we could fix this all. You just have to rent this modem.
Oh god, yeah, no, I unplugged it, and I plug it back
in. Swung it around the air, smash it against the floor.
I did, voodoo magic on it, and then ended up having to call Comcast. And like, oh yeah, we'll reset it, but you really should get a new modem.
Yeah.
I was like, well, just reset it, and we'll see how it works. Okay.
Dexter has a nice comment in the chat room. He's saying, oh, WAN side remote management. Oh, hacking galore. Yeah, it is. That's what it is. It's their network, so they can reach into your device at any time, which is why I hate having them integrate the router into the modem, because it means they can mess with my router, too. I don't I buy the connection. I want the connection to the internet.
That's all
But once they get to my house, I don't want them having anything to do with my router.
Right.
Which,
And they're huge, too. It's like a box this big.
Is it a router or is it a bread box?
Yeah, exactly.
A bread box.
Yep.
Fantastic. Well, we know that this was a lot of information to take in one show, especially the Linux tips. So we want to give you an easy way to get the show. Download it so that you can replay it at your own leisure, or perhaps even take a look at our show notes. Where can they find those, Brian?
They can find those at twit.tv/KH, and you can also subscribe to the show. All the different versions of video. We've got HD and some of the lower res versions, depending on how much of a file you want to download. But follow us there at twit.tv. But you can also find us on YouTube. I really like that screenshot from last week.
That was a good one.
But also, like we were just showing, on Google Plus, you can hang out in the community, see what other projects people are working on. Like we were demonstrating, people post questions, and fortunately, we were able to answer this one today, but a lot of the time, it's other community members that get to it before we do. So,
which is nice.
Yeah, no, it's a thriving knowledge community.
Knowledge hole?
Yeah, find another metaphor.
I think we've used up the knowledge
hole. It's like a knowledge barrel that you put stuff in.
It's a knowledge cave. It's a knowledge cave, and you put the knowledge in, and then you forge. No, never mind. Also, you can email us at knowhow@twit.tv. That email goes straight into the garbage can. So instead, why not reach out to us on Twitter? You can find me at twitter.com/PadreSJ. That's at PadreSJ.
And I'm at Cranky_Hippo.
Yeah.
I always have to think about
cranky
that for a second.
Hippo.
It works.
How long have you used that name?
A while.
Don't forget, we've also got a super TD. Probably doesn't have a camera turned on himself because he's... Oh, no, there, he is.
There he is.
Oh,
in the shadows.
He's doing it in the shadows.
I think he's in the knowledge cave.
That's Alex.
He's deep in the knowledge cave. There's no light.
Straight from the knowledge cave, this is Alex, our TD. You can find him on Twitter at anelf3, A-N-E-L-F-3, and maybe he'll regale you with some of his tales of flying with Brian as a passenger.
Yes. Actually, we have some documented footage that we're going to save for...
Isn't it supposed to be an episode of Know-How?
It's a filler.
Wow. All right. Well, until next time, I'm Father Robert Ballas here.
And I'm Brian Burnett.
And now that you know how...
Go do it.